You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, May 18th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Nathan Tankus, the Modern Money Network Research Director, on what we're going to do and what we're doing to mitigate massive depression. Meanwhile, Trump fires the State Department Inspector General. Was it really about dog walking? Or was it in fact about a near-completed investigation into the fast-tracking of arms sales to Saudi Arabia? Also on the program today, on Friday, Democrats passed the biggest, most unambitious relief bill ever. They do, however, change the rules to allow for remote voting, which is the first time the House has had such rules in 231 years. Meanwhile, the Fed chair warns of 25% unemployment. Google to face federal and state antitrust suits in coming weeks, months. Cell phone data suggests that the lockdown protests may have spread COVID wide and far. FDA halts coronavirus testing program backed by Bill Gates. This is another one of Jared Kushner's ideas. And Texas had a massive spike of new cases on Saturday. Fell back down on Sunday. We need more information, but Trump's administration says no spikes in opening states. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the show. I don't know the best way to get into this, and I don't want to spend too much time on it. This show is not really about this type of thing, but my good friend lost his very close girlfriend over the weekend. You probably have heard about this, maybe in the news, but Marc Maron had been involved with Lynn Shelton. She was a director of TV and film. She passed away on Saturday of a blood infection that had nothing to do with COVID-19. But I, you know, can only imagine that maybe during a different era or a different time when there wasn't a pandemic, that maybe a doctor would have caught what was going on quicker. But she apparently had some type of blood disorder. I'm not quite clear, but it's a heartbreaking story for Mark. And I don't know. I know we have, you know, obviously share some fans, so listeners, longtime listeners. So, you know, if you have the opportunity to send some condolences to Mark on Twitter, probably wouldn't hurt. You can go. He posted an interview. The first time he met her actually was on his show. It's pretty heartbreaking. But my heart goes out to Mark. tough time for folks right now. We lost Fred Willard, too, of natural causes. He was 86, so was able to live a good life. I think he would probably appreciate this.
Hey, what happened?
He passed away. Very funny guy. I don't know that I ever had an opportunity to meet him. If I did, it was very brief. But I just, as a comedian, I've always had a lot of appreciation for the work he has done. So, all right. Well, let's move on. I was planning about talking about that later, but just what are you going to do? All right, let's move on to some, which I'm sure we all, in many respects, would like to be able to completely divorce ourselves from reality that is existing now. A lot of hardship out there. There's going to be a lot more coming, both in terms of health problems and deaths and economic hardship. We are on the... it's unclear at this point, you know, where we're at in terms of that that economic hardship. We will talk more about that with Nathan Tankus. But in the meantime, here is Eric Trump on a day where we've basically lost, I think, as of yesterday, probably 87,000 Americans. We're up to close to 90,000 Americans who have passed away as of today. We are at best 25% infection rate in New York at best, 5-7% maybe the rest of the country at best. Hopefully we'll get some treatments that will deal with this, but here's Eric Trump basically explaining that this is all basically a hoax. Still, they're still saying this.
76 days to be exact away. And listen, Biden loves this. Biden can't go on stage without making some horrible blunder. I mean, even from his basement, he's making awful gaffes every single day. So his campaign's thrilled that he's not going out there. And they think they're taking away Donald Trump's greatest tool, which is being able to go into an arena and fill it with 50,000 people every single time, right? So they will, and you watch, they'll milk it every single day between now and November 3rd. And guess what? After November 3rd, coronavirus will magically all of a sudden go away and disappear, and everybody will be able to reopen. They're trying to deprive him of his greatest asset, which is the fact that the American people love him, the fact that he's relatable, the fact that he can go out there and draw massive crowds. Joe Biden can't get 10 people in a room. My father's getting 50,000 in a room, and they want to do everything they can to stop it. So make no mistake, to a lot of them, Janine, to a lot of them, this is a very cognizant strategy that they're trying to employ. It's no different than, again, the nonsense that they're trying to throw in the HOPE Act. It's no different than the mail-in voting that they want to do all these places. It's no different than wanting illegal immigrants to vote in our country. It is a cognizant strategy. And it's sad. And again, it's not going to be allowed to happen. We're going to win November.
Think about the level of pathology and insanity involved in going on national television and every single human being who is involved in bringing that to you. I mean, almost down to the sound engineers that are just sitting there and just like don't have the, you know, they've got jobs to do. I can understand that. But the idea that I guess the stay at home orders are a strategy by Democrats to help Joe Biden. How insane do you have to be to actually, I don't know how insane you have to be to actually believe it. No, but the question is, how insane do you have to be to go and say that on television in front of people? This is a strategy. Democrats don't control anything. They don't certainly don't control any of the states I guess it's Wisconsin. They don't control Wisconsin. They think this is all a strategy so that Donald Trump can't do a rally in Long Island. or in Albany or in LA. It's nuts. This is what a suicide cult looks like. And, you know, we'll never know if the leader of this cult and his family actually believe this stuff or not. We won't know. I suspect, though, that they will not be, the ones sipping on that Kool-Aid when that happens. But that's just bizarre. I don't know when the second wave is going to hit. I don't know if we're going to see spikes on these states that have opened up in the near term. But at one point or another, just like you could see that data with Sean Hannity, these people are going to be responsible for the deaths of thousands of people. And maybe also the economic deprivation, because they will have, we will at one point have to go back in to clean up the damage in a way that is far more intense than we're experiencing now, to clean up the damage that these people are creating. It's unbelievable. They're nuts. Really nuts. Couple of ads, and then we will speak with Nathan Tankus. For all our sakes, we need to avoid crowds in any way we can right now. But what if you need to go to the post office? What if you need postage, send out letters and packages? Well, don't worry. Stamps.com is here to help. With Stamps.com, you can print postage on demand, skip those lines and crowds at the post office. You can personally print official U.S. postage 24/7 for any letter, any package, any class of mail for anywhere. My daughter is on a Depop kick right now, which is where you sell clothes on online. It's basically her business model is I buy her clothes, she sells them, and then she thinks she's made money. But she's gone to town on this. So all you got to do is you print it out. You can do it anywhere at any time. She does it 3 a.m. You just leave it for your mail carrier. You can schedule a free package pickup, or you drop it in a mailbox. No human contact required. Whether you're a small business sending invoices, an online seller shipping out products, or you can just working from home, you need to mail stuff. Stamps.com can handle it with ease. With Stamps.com, you get great discounts too. 5 cents off every first class stamp and up to 62% off USPS shipping rates. And now Stamps.com offers UPS service with discounts up to 62%. You won't even have to pay UPS residential surcharges. Right now, get a special offer that includes 4-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale without any long-term commitment. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Majority Report. That's Stamps.com. Enter the code Majority Report. Folks, you know the New Yorker publishes the best writing by the most influential authors in the world. You don't need me to tell you this. They've got award-winning reporting. They got political commentary. They got cultural criticism. They got fiction and poetry, cartoons, and more. In addition to the weekly print magazine, NewYorker.com has become a daily digital destination for news and cultural coverage, the complimentary app that provides the best of both worlds. I've told you folks in the past that when we started getting ads from the New Yorker, it's one of the few times I've actually been like proud of myself in some way. I've read the magazine for, I don't know now, 30 some odd years. And, I read it on a weekly basis. This morning I read, this piece from March 16th. I think someone must have tweeted it out. I think maybe it was Brooks. What Mike Flynn did for Turkey to remind me of the issues that had nothing to do with Russia, with Mike Flynn, that had to do with the fact that he was on the payroll of a foreign government while he was, named the, NSC chief. Just a little problem, but, New Yorker's an incredible resource for stuff like that. Plus, not only can you, right now you go over there, Dexter Filikins has a great piece on the twilight of the Iranian Revolution. There's all sorts of amazing stuff every week. You don't need me to tell you about it in the New Yorker, but I will say this, that one, I read it for work, and two, I read it so I can also sort of like, you know, it's my one cultural like tether, if you will. And they have the best writing that exists. New Yorker's exceptional writers make them unique. Theater critic Hilton Alls, who won the 2017 Pulitzer Prize for criticism. Multiple award-winning Robin Wright covers politics and international affairs, specializing in stories about the Middle East. And now you can get 12 weeks for just $6, half the regular cost, plus a limited edition tote bag. You get home delivery of the print edition each week, along with unlimited access to NewYorker.com, which includes 10 to 15 exclusive site-only stories every day. This deal also includes app access, online archives dating back to 1925, crossword puzzles, and more. Get 12 weeks of The New Yorker for just $6, plus the limited edition tote at newyorker.com/majority. You will save 50% when you enter the code majority at checkout. So again, newyorker.com/majority, and then majority in the checkout coupon code. Also, one of the things that brought Mile and I together, this is even before COVID, but we're doing a lot of this now. I wish I could double up on it. You can take advantage of this time at home. Break out Hunt a Killer. It's a murder mystery game that gets sent to you each month. And it's like a new episode every week of a murder until you solve it. It's a good way to switch up things from watching TV and getting kids off the screens. It reinvents the way we interact with murder mysteries. So you go from a viewer watching this safe in the comfort of your own home to an investigator actively involved in solving the case. The subscription box has over 2,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot. Each delivery, you'll sift through piles of documents, evidence, audio recordings, and case files, eliminating suspects until you crack the case. You can even join Hunt a Killer's spoiler-free community. It has 100,000 members, so they give you a little bit of clues and theories, and you can talk about it. You can get deep, deep, deep into this, believe me. Plus, part of the proceeds for every box goes to the Cold Case Foundation. Like I say, Mile and I love it. We left the board back in Brooklyn, but we're still playing it hard. It's, you know, the beauty about this, it's like, it's reminiscent of, you know, it's not D&D, but you're deep involved in this. And you get to test out theories. The thing I like about it is that, you know, we can actually have conversations about stuff, you know, during breakfast, you know, or wherever. I don't know. We don't eat breakfast that often together. But during lunch or dinner or just in passing, I had a thought about this. I had a thought about that guy. Right now, for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority and use promo code majority at checkout for 20% off your first box. Head to huntakiller.com/majority, 20% off now. Show support for our podcast. That's huntakiller.com/majority. And lastly, all this week, we are sponsored by Sunset Lake CBD. This is they're listeners of the show, fans of the show. TJ sent me a bunch of stuff to test. Matt, I want you to jump in here because Matt is the connoisseur. For me, it's been all about the tincture. But let me just tell you a little bit. They're located in Vermont, outside of Burlington. Huge Bernie folks, too, incidentally. It was a former family-owned dairy farm, which produced milk for Ben and Jerry's ice cream. In 2018, they decided to diversify, and they've been growing hemp for CBD. No pesticides. They use organic fertilizer. You can come and view the third-party tests for results of all their products at Sunset Lake CBD. They sent me a bunch of stuff, all that was certified. They also have amazing business practices. Minimum wage is $15 an hour. Employees own the majority of the company. And this is basically, I mean, Matt can give you a good sense of what the smoke in the CBD is. But I've got some here. First of all, it smells amazing. Mila came into my office. She's like, "Dad, what are you doing? We had all the pot out in your bureau." I'm like, "It's not pot." CBD. And the thing that's nice about it is I've used two of the products so far. I haven't smoked any of this stuff. I'm going to soon. But I can tell you from the tincture, I've been sleeping awesome. I've had it now for almost like 10 days. The 750 milligrams. I take one teaser like 15 minutes before I go to bed. What do you call it? Those little squirty things. I've been sleeping like a baby. And they're CBD infused coffee. It's like a nice Sunday morning type of thing for me. I mean, I can't because I need to be revved up and I can't be calm during the week. That's not healthy for me. But it's been amazing, all of it. And, you know, I don't know. Matt, I know you're very skeptical about the CBD, but why don't you tell us how you've been using it?
Yeah, I was actually a big CBD skeptic. I had a bad experience when I was in Los Angeles last year. But as you can see, I have some of the special sauce here.
Not much left of that.
I have smoked some of it. I'm glad they sent me a lot of it, actually. I got like, they sent me a ton of this stuff. But I must say, for sleeping, this is my main use for it. I think it is a really nice, it's like a nice body high, I guess they call it, or something like that.
Yeah.
It's not psychoactive.
That's the point, right?
Yeah. If you're somebody who gets like paranoid on other substances, for instance, this won't, I think probably won't have the same effect because it's not activating the same thing. It's a completely different thing. But like you said, I was very skeptical of CBD. I was not very optimistic about this. But I mean, I don't know if this is just more, if they just have a better process or something or whatever, all the pesticide-free farmer-owned Vermont growth. But it turned me into a complete believer into CBD.
All right. Well, save some more of that.
There you go.
Don't blow it all now. Folks, go to Sunset. See sunsetlakecbd.com, sunsetlakecbd.com. Use the coupon code best, left is best for 20% off. Left is best for 20% off at Sunset Lake CBD. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Be right back with Nathan Tankus. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Nathan Tankus. He is the research director of the Modern Money Network. Nathan, I appreciate your coming on the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
I know that what you were doing prior to COVID-19 had to do with looking into the monetary policy that would be behind a Green New Deal. You shifted over to talking about the response, the Fed's response to COVID-19. I don't know what we would call this from an economic perspective, but the fallout from a pandemic, I guess. And I know that you're not an economist per se, but your research on this has been, you know, you're getting quite a bit of acclaim for the work you're doing. And you're used to speaking to people who are very well versed in economics. Well, today you're going to elementary school for the rest of us. But before we get there, let's start with just, why don't you just tell us what the Modern Money Network is and just tell folks about like the post-Keynesian I guess, school of thought of money?
Yeah, sure. So the Modern Money Network is a nonprofit, a 501c3 that's focused on education around money and economics, especially the interrelations between economics and law from a kind of macro perspective, looking at money, looking at employment, looking at price stability, focusing on, you know, these kind of big macroeconomic issues, and education around money that there tends to be not very much around. Like money is a kind of subject that we, you know, live our whole day talking about, but it's the mechanics of it, how it works, in the plumbing behind the scenes, isn't something that is necessarily taught at any level, all the way down from, elementary school, high school, all the way up to undergraduate, law school, graduate school. And the Modern Money Network started at Columbia Law School as a way of generating education around money and finance, and thinking that money and macroeconomics was something that was important for everyone to know about, but especially the people who essentially designed the system, lawyers.
Right. And so the idea being that, I guess more, sort of lay people on some level, or theoretically. I mean, the thing that that we see a lot is where people just freak out and say they're printing money out of thin air, as opposed to what?
Yeah, exactly. There's a perpetual shock at how the system works at a very basic level. And, I think that, we have so little literacy around money that, if you ask a lot of people, about half of them would think that the money that is out there is backed by a bunch of gold at Fort Knox. The more you probably get more education about how money works, like from Bond movies, than you do in any other part of your life. And that's, not exactly a great education in terms of how money works. And so we have these perpetual forgetting, and then every crisis, suddenly there's a lot of attention on what the Federal Reserve is doing and what Congress is doing. And suddenly there's this sudden realization and all these questions around these issues, and then a forgetting. And the Modern Money Network was founded after the great financial crisis to try to keep that flame alive, and try to put out their materials on educating about money, so that people have a more of a money literacy when these big crises happen.
And we should say, I mean, this is associated with the modern monetary theory, correct?
Yeah. Okay. Yes. They were all close colleagues of a set of economists, Professor Stephanie Kelton, Scott Fulweiler, and so on, and many others. Definitely close associated and closely working with them, but also a focus, a little bit more of a focus on the legal side, on the legal analysis of things, and on, and kind of expanding out this project to be more interdisciplinary and, more deeply rooted in law.
Okay. And folks can go back, and if they Google Majority Report, Stephanie Kelton, we've had her on, three or four times. And we've gone through the specifics of this. It was years ago, but still obviously the same. And all right. So let's just talk about, give us a sense of what is money. I mean, let's just start with there, and then we'll get into sort of what the Fed has been doing, and what is new that the Fed is doing that they haven't done before, and what the implications are. But just give us this basic understanding of what money is, and go slow through the parts with the accounting.
Yeah. So at the most basic level, money is a tax credit. It's a tool that we use to settle our obligations with the government. You show up, you have a fine, a fee, or you have a tax bill. You have to pay that in something. And this is a step that's so obvious that we overlook it, but it's actually kind of everything. It's crucially important. Whatever you can pay your taxes with, makes that thing that you can pay your taxes with really valuable. you can pay your taxes with pigs, pigs are suddenly really valuable. If you can pay your taxes with chickens, chickens are suddenly really valuable. So at this most fundamental level, money, what is money, is something that you can settle your obligations with, whether it's the court, whether it's the state, whether it's another private actor, but it's all determined by legal systems. You know, a court says what you can pay your obligation with. A court, you know, adjudicates, you know, a contract dispute and says, you know, what is an appropriate way to settle this contract between two people. So from MMT's view, from the modern monetary theory view, it's that ability to settle obligations that makes something money, or the ability to convert whatever item you have into something that you can pay your taxes with, essentially.
All right.
Also fines, fees, court judgments.
So just to be clear here, in this also, and this is for my libertarian friends, this comes from an entity having a monopoly of force and saying and decreeing, this is how we're going to settle your, we're going to impose debts on you, the taxes, and like you say, fees and other things like that from the government. And this is the only thing, or one of the things, this is what we will take to call us even here. And so without taxes, and I guess presumably fees and whatnot, but without government obligations in terms of what we must pay to the government in some fashion or another, the money we would have has no value. It becomes like a cryptocurrency, which has value only to the extent that people will buy it in the same way that like baseball cards do, or those puka shells at like, you know, when you go to like a all-encompassing, you know, vacation place or something like that, and you can use it at the bar. It's only where, you know, they agree on some level, right? But in terms of universality within a society, and in certain instances outside of the society, it's just a function of what the government will take to square your debts with the government.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's whatever you can use to get even.
Right. And that concept of getting even becomes really important in this concept of accounting, right?
Yes. Absolutely. Because the other fundamental thing about these relations is that one entity's or person's IOU is another person's asset. So that, you know, whether it's cash in your hand or a government security, that item is something that is an IOU, it's a debt of the government and an asset to us. It's something we hold. It's something that's worth money to us, but it's a debt to them. The difference is, you know, our debts, you know, don't generally have a lot of money in it. I usually can't, you know, pay someone by just writing a Tinkus IOU and saying, you know, I love, you know, nice, great 5-star restaurant you have. I love this meal. Here's my IOU. You know, enjoy that. But with the government, you essentially do have that. A government can't just emit a bunch of IOUs. It can send out checks that, you know, you get a nice little balance statement. But all that balance statement really tells you is that you have some IOUs from the government, but you're happy with that because you can pay your taxes, you can pay court judgments, and ultimately because all these, you know, sets of payments are denominated in dollars, you know, other people who sell goods and services also accept dollars. So it's accepted everywhere.
Will you make that, a government IOU, will you make that more tangible? Like, when do we see a government IOU?
You mean, when do we first see it?
No, but I mean, when do, like in the course of our daily lives, like what?
Oh,
what?
You open your pocket. If you open your pocket, you take out a note right now, and it will say the Federal Reserve note. It'll be signed by a Federal Reserve official and a Treasury official. And it will say that, you know, it's accepted for all obligations, public and private. You know, the most basic level, the physical cash in your pocket is an IOU of the federal government.
And the federal government, you know, just like basically issues these IOUs, and they become valuable to trade because the government ultimately is going to require, you know, something of value from everybody you're giving it to or could give it to. And therefore, it never actually has to be anything other than a promise to pay, because ultimately you're paying it back to the government. And the government is like, yeah, our promise to pay, we're going to pay ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it relies on there's this whole set of payments that you can settle in dollars, so it never has to offer you anything else. It doesn't need to offer you, we'll give you this nice shiny object if you turn it in. It gives you, you know, we'll settle your tax bill and we won't put you in jail, or you'll be able to settle your debt with, you know, with your ex-wife or whatever it is. It gives you the ability to settle whatever obligations that you encounter in a society that are court ordered and such. And, you know, that is so valuable to people. In fact, it's so valuable that we hoard it, that we accumulate as much as we can, for fear of whatever future obligations or expenses that we're going to encounter in the future.
Okay. And so will you just tell us the relationship between debt and savings? Because I want to just get all these basics sort of like tenets down before we go into what the Fed is doing, because I think it'll help, you know, to make sure that we're all on the same sort of page, as it were.
Sure. And so the corollary of all this, that, you know, the government's IOU is our assets, you know, there, you know, is that, you know, at an aggregate level, for every financial asset is also in turn someone's financial obligation. So as a result, when the government runs a deficit, when the government spends more than it takes in, there must be corresponding surpluses out there, whether that's households or businesses or state and local governments or the rest of the world. Someone has to be getting more dollars than they're giving up, essentially, if the federal government is deficit spending. So that's always money in someone's pocket, always, you know, increasing someone's, you know, level of financial assets when the government runs a deficit, and vice versa. And the flip side is, when the government is running a surplus, usually that means we're running deficits. So, you know, if we're spending much more than we're taking in, when the Federal Reserve, when not the Federal Reserve, when the federal government is running a surplus, you know, that surplus is literally taking money out of our pockets.
Okay. So, all right. Now I want to slow down even on this. And because I can remember those words, and I've stated them myself, but I really want people to understand this from a conceptual standpoint. So the government borrows money and it has debt. And it, or it spends more than it has, right? Like it's not spending more than it has, because it really has an unlimited potential, I guess, right? Of money, theoretically. And it's spending more than it has because it's spending more than it's taken in from its citizenry. Right. And, you know, let's just say it that way for ease. But even though the U.S. government probably takes in money, like, oh, I'm taking in fees from non-citizens, whatever. But let's just say that it's spending more than it's taken in. And it's doing that by either printing the money or by just simply issuing IOUs by some other form, like, you know, not necessarily verbal, but some other instrument that doesn't look like cash. It could be just we have an electronic IOU, and that tender is we just put it in your bank account. So boom, your numbers are up because we have a relationship with the bank. So, and that's what it means when they're spending money they don't have, that there's that much more savings on the other side, because the equilibrium is what the government takes in from its citizens and then spends it out. If it spends out, so if it takes in 10 and it spends out 10, there's an equilibrium. But if it takes in 10 and spends out 20, that extra 10 has to be somewhere. And it necessarily, if it's not with the government, has to be with the citizens.
Yeah. Yeah. At the most fun level, that's true. There's some complicated stuff with the rest of the world, but if you just take, you know, say like there's an isolated, just take one country, forget about the rest of the world, you know, that government spends $1,000 and collects $900 in taxes, you know, some person or group of people have to have collectively $100 left over. That's right. Just, you know, cash they have on hand or money in a bank account that they have on hand. There has to be some surplus that people have that corresponds to the federal government's deficit. And, you know, so fundamentally, if we want to, you know, if we want to accumulate financial assets, if we want to, you know, make sure that we have a bunch of savings that can protect us in a crisis, and, you know, not be so deep in debt ourselves, then, you know, then the federal government probably is going to be the one that has to deficit spend in order for there to be money in our pockets or collectively, you know, the corporate America and households all together. Something like that has to be the case.
All right. Now, I just want to go through the other way where the government has a surplus. That means that they take in $900 and instead of spending $1,000 and instead of spending $900, they only spend $800. So the government is tightening its belt, as it were. And now they have an extra $100. But that extra $100 means that it is there's $100 less circulating around in the private sector. And that means that people had to go into debt. Somebody had to, or maybe, you know, everybody had to go into debt by a penny or whatever, 0.001 of a penny or something, to pay their bill to the government.
They have to. Absolutely. Usually they have to get into more debt to pay. You know, there's some unique time periods where people have just so much cash that the government running a surplus just takes cash out of their hands rather than putting them into debt. Like, for example, after World War II, the deficits were so big in World War II that when you had a couple periods where they ran surpluses and where the federal government ran surpluses in the 1940s or the early 50s or whatever, what that did was just took cash that people had accumulated during the war.
There was so much slack. There was so much slack in the system that it just basically was working on slack and then ultimately tightened up. Okay.
But that slack went away over the decades. I mean, that's like one of these big conceptual points is that we had these huge deficits during World War II where everyone essentially accumulated cash, had a bunch of money on hand, whether they were businesses or corporations. And that gave the system a lot of flexibility, times when the federal government could run surpluses and it wasn't going to cause huge problems. But over time, that period faded. We kept on having these periods where we ran relatively small budget deficits. And over time, the private sector got more and more into debt, and we, you know, reached the high private debt levels that we did in the great financial crisis and after.
Okay, and so and then one other point here, and I just want to make sure that we make a distinction between sort of tax policy, as it were, and the idea of like of taxation, because the government doesn't need to tax to spend money. And we've just said they can basically just issue IOUs, and that's what they do. They don't need the money to issue the IOUs. But taxing is really about A, making sure that the money has value. If there were no taxes and the government required no taxes and no fees from us, then all of a sudden the money would be, we would just rely on the fact that everybody agrees we're going to spend this, but then eventually people would start catching on going like, wait a second, we don't need dollars to pay taxes. Maybe these, you know, the CEDAR bills are good or whatever it is, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And we should also say that taxation is a way of, you can deal with like wealth inequality or whatnot. And this is,
absolutely.
We're talking about the federal taxes here, because when we talk about state and local taxes, that doesn't have an impact. That doesn't have implications for monetary policy, because in the same way, because they're just subsidiaries of the federal government.
Yeah.
Okay.
The big thing I would say though, is that state and local governments are something that the federal government has to take into account when they're deciding on their spending policy, on their tax policy, because, you know, people might look at the federal government number and be like, oh, that deficit, it's so big. But generally, usually, you know, outside of huge crises like this, state and local governments are running surpluses, and the Federal Reserve, or the federal government, has to offset for that. That it has to, you know, if the state and local governments are running surpluses, then the deficit that the federal government runs has to be even larger in order for you and I to, you know, experience surpluses, or the businesses to experience surpluses. And that's, you know, that's the huge problem right now, is that because tax revenues have collapsed across the board, state and local governments have lost all this money. They need money directly from the federal government to get them out of their fiscal troubles.
Okay, and so let's just be clear. We have fiscal and monetary policy. These are two basically, they're related, but they're not the same. Will you just make that distinction clear to people? Because we're going to be talking about monetary policy as opposed to fiscal policy, right, in this conversation for the most part.
Yeah. So fiscal policy is exactly what we've just been talking about. Spending and taxing, it's what, you know, gives us surpluses. If the government runs a deficit, we get a surplus, you know, as we've just been talking about. Monetary policy is different, because monetary policy doesn't directly, you know, affect whether people are running surpluses or deficits. Instead, monetary policy is about the terms at which they can finance their debts or finance their deficit. It, you know, monetary policy is, we're going to buy a whole bunch of government bonds to lower interest rates. Monetary policy, as we'll be talking about, is we're going to buy a whole bunch of bonds from the corporate sector to lower the interest rate that they pay and make sure they have access to finance. Monetary policy is, we can buy the debts of state and local governments to make sure that they lower the interest rate that they pay and that they can find finance. But that isn't mean that they don't have, you know, that they suddenly have a surplus when they did have a deficit. When you conduct monetary policy, when you do these purchases and sales, instead it's just affecting the financing, which is important, but it can't replace lost income. And that'll be, you know, previewing something we'll talk a lot more about, is that, you know, you can have all the monetary policy in the world, but if a company has lost a whole ton of income and has a big deficit, the monetary policy won't make that deficit go away.
Right. It might keep you afloat for a while, but at one point you're going to have to deal with it.
Yeah.
All right. And just to be clear, broadly speaking, Congress deals with fiscal policy and the Fed deals with monetary policy.
Exactly.
And, but there's also a relationship between the Treasury and the Fed that begins to sort of arguably blur that line a little bit.
Yeah. So I would say, I just described monetary policy as purchase and sale policy, where you purchase financial assets and you sell financial assets out there. Well, the Treasury, you know, not when it spends or taxes or is involved in the spending and taxing process, doesn't blur those lines. But when it engages in sales, when it sells financial assets, it absolutely is blurring that line. And the big time that they do that is when they sell Treasury securities. You know, that process where you're selling Treasury securities, and there's a whole bunch of net issuance out there, that's affecting interest rates for if they sell 10-year bonds, that affects interest rates for 10-year bonds. And the Federal Reserve has to respond. And so, you know, if the Federal Reserve selling a Treasury security is monetary policy, then, you know, arguably, you know, I would make the case that the Treasury doing that is monetary policy. And it leads to some complications, because the Treasury thinks of its job mainly as, you know, financing federal spending, as making sure that the federal government can make its bills. And so it uses these Treasury securities to do that, because that's the main instrument outside of a couple others we could name that it can use to do that. But the Federal Reserve thinks of it as a monetary policy instrument. It thinks of it as these bonds as a way to affect interest rates. And that leads to some tension. There's been conflict over the decades between the Federal Reserve and the Treasury over their different outlooks over how how they should treat, how they should deal with Treasury securities.
Okay. So, and just to be, let me just, reduce this down so that I can understand it. The, when we say Treasury security, we're talking about, you know, generally speaking, like bonds. We're going to borrow money. And the way we're going to borrow money is we're going to sell, Janet and Steve a bond for $100 that they're going to give Sam to it for his bar mitzvah. And in 20 years, it'll be worth $100. They paid $75. We're going to give them interest. So basically, they're giving us a loan, the government a loan, and we're going to pay it back with interest in 20 years. Sam's going to get this like a little bond. Obviously, the bonds are a little bit bigger and they get sold to other people, but that's the dynamic that's going on there. And when the Treasury starts to sell these bonds, they set interest rates on them and they'll do them at different terms. This will be, $100 in 10 years or 15 years or 20 years. And that impacts how much money is out there because it allows the government to deficit spend. And that adds a surplus in the private sector. And therefore, it begins to implicate monetary policy that the Fed's, it's sort of like the Fed's arena. So it's like Fed's a big bank, but the Treasury is such a big client that they can impact it. Is that it?
Yeah, a little bit. One thing I would say there is that, you know, I would separate the selling of the Treasury security from the deficit. So, you know, that the selling the Treasury security is, you know, will potentially enable them to deficit spend at another time or, you know, meet payments at a later date. But the selling of the Treasury security itself doesn't affect those balances out there. You know, they sell a Treasury security to the private sector. The private sector, say, you know, hands over cash or hands over a bank deposit, whatever it is. That's exchange of one financial asset for another. Nothing happens in terms of deficits or surpluses. It's only later when the federal government goes out and spends that, you know, it's running a deficit. And that's important because we can, you know, as I've been writing a lot about recently, we can rearrange these relationships. We can, you know, say, you know, this is stupid. Why are we, you know, having the Treasury be responsible for it, for issuing this instrument? Because, you know, the Federal Reserve should really be in charge of selling bonds because it's the one that's concerned about interest rates. It's the one that wants, you know, to set certain interest rates on a 10-year bond or a 20-year bond. It's the one that was worried about how many 10-year bonds are circulating in the private sector. It's the one that wants to manage all these processes, and what it would do to choose to do that is different than what the Treasury would choose. And, you know, while from the Treasury's point of view, it's looking at this as, oh, the national debt that it's using to finance itself, but the Federal Reserve and the financiers that the Federal Reserve interacts with is looking at a Treasury security and saying, this is the safest asset in the world. If I want to put $100 million somewhere and I want to guarantee that I'm not going to lose my money, what I want to do is buy a Treasury security. You know, I can't put it in a bank because the bank has insurance, has deposit insurance caps. So my big option, if I want to make sure that I have $100 million and I'll have $100 million in 20 years, is by buying a bond. And that role of being a safe asset, of being, you know, providing something to investors, is what the Federal Reserve really cares about. And, you know, the decisions it would make would be different than the Treasury would make. And in the meantime, you know, as we can talk about in a bit, you know, everyone gets very confused or gets worried about the national debt and isn't thinking about it the way the financiers and the central bankers are thinking.
And the reason why I think that my $100 billion is going to be there in 20 years is because the U.S. government has the ability to tax a massive population, essentially, that is highly productive. And that makes it the safest bet in the world. Is that basically it?
That the federal government will create dollars and absolutely make its payments no matter what. That you can rely on the federal government is going to make its payments, and the money you get at the end of that process is going to be valuable because of the system of payments that are denominated in dollars. You know, there's so many countries around the world that owe dollars, and corporations and banks around the world that owes dollars. There's a huge population within the United States that owes dollars in all these different ways that you can rely, not just that, you know, some bureaucrat is going to, quote unquote, print money and, you know, and provide you money, but that money is probably going to have, is still be valuable, you know, 10, 20 years down the line.
All right. And lastly, I mean, just, this idea, you know, that, the people, you know, I mean, in the wake of the financial crisis, I remember going on TV with David Stockman, who was the Office of Budget Management director under Reagan. And he would come on and he would say PIMCO, which is the biggest bond buyer, I guess, or, you know, one of the biggest bond buyers in the country, you know, is selling their bonds, and the you know, by July, we're going to have rampant inflation. And, you know, I think this was in 2010 or 11. I can't remember when it was. Everything's going to crash and there's going to be inflation and people won't want to buy our bonds anymore. And so when you say that, when people like that are worried about stuff, they're not looking at it in the way that investors do, because none of that, those things happened. I mean, Glenn Beck and there was a whole industry out there telling us that we were going to turn into the Weimar Republic because of quantitative easing and whatnot, which is, and none of that happened. So
yeah, no, the people who bet against Treasury securities lost a lot of money.
And okay. So with all that said, tell us what the Fed has been doing now and what it needs to do going forward from your perspective. There have been three major, as far as I can tell from reading you and obviously reading the news, there have been three major things that the Fed has done, some of which is sort of radically new for the Fed. That's the Main Street Lending Program, the Paycheck Protection Liquidity Facility, and the Municipal Liquidity Program. And then you also talk a lot about alternative accounting. Let's start with, I don't know, which one of those do you want to start with that makes it easier?
Well, I think the three big ones are, what I would say is, instead of the Paycheck Protection one, it's the corporate credit facilities.
Okay,
there's
right.
These two
right.
Corporate credit facilities. So that's the big picture. The big picture is the Fed is experimenting with something which isn't completely unprecedented in its history, but is pretty rare, which is direct lending to small and medium-sized businesses. The Main Street Lending Program, it's got these corporate credit facilities, which is also pretty unprecedented for them, which is buying corporate bonds both on the secondary market, meaning from private financiers who are holding them or speculating on them, and directly from corporations. And then the third one is the Municipal Liquidity Facility, which is buying state and local government securities. And all of these, in some degree or another, are pretty unprecedented for the Fed. But the Main Street Lending Program is the biggest one, is definitely the biggest kind of, you know, outside, where it's the most uncomfortable.
Okay. So I want to just say this too. This is not a substitute, obviously, for fiscal. Well, it can have some substitution, I guess, effects, but we're focusing on this. But we should also say that obviously there needs to be fiscal actions too. Congress needs to support other, you know, support people as well in spending. But we're just focusing on this with the Fed right now because our government is completely incapable of getting its craft together on some level, and there's more independence by the Fed, it seems like.
That's the big picture here. Monetary policy would have a role in this crisis, but the focus on it and how much it's doing relative to how much Congress and the rest of the federal government is doing is completely lopsided. You know, the fundamental problem from a macroeconomic point of view, you know, the fallout from the virus is that a whole bunch of businesses and households and also state and local governments have lost a tremendous amount of income because we've quote unquote shut down the economy, because we've shut down these public spaces, because a whole ton of people have lost their jobs, and the knock on effects from that, you know, millions upon millions upon millions, unprecedented level of job losses in the last 2 months. And that that process, you know, the thing that we ultimately need to deal with that problem is income. And as we've just been talked about, you know, when the federal government runs a deficit, the rest of the economy runs a surplus, we need a much bigger deficit to offset those income losses. And you know, cash in your pocket, which they've already done a little bit, but much more on a much grander scale than they're already contemplating. But because we've had a politics for decades and decades around deficits being the worst thing in the world, you got to try to balance the budget. Whenever it comes down to a crisis and Congress spends, it doesn't spend at the scale of what the crisis needs. It spends on like balancing seeming like it's doing a lot with the political concerns about the deficit further down the line. And that's our kind of big problem right now, is that they're doing things like with the payroll protection program, which is supposed to be essentially direct grants directly to small businesses. It's capping that, and it's capping that not for any economic reason why it makes sense for only $400 billion or $710 billion to go out the door. It's capping that because, politically, it's very hard for them to wrap around their mind around an uncapped program where first come, first serve, and everyone gets money.
And we should say what that is the functional equivalent of, it seems to me, is just sort of like holding your breath when you go by a cemetery, or, literally it's superstition, right? I mean, it's just like learned superstition, because Nancy Pelosi, was friends with Pete Peterson, and was espousing PAYGO. They look at a messaging bill, right, which doesn't even spend money, because they know it's not going to spend money, and they're still afraid to have it go over. Like, they're still saying stuff like, we're nervous about, how much money we're spending after $3 trillion. I mean, not all this is an abstraction. It's literally like, 1,000 years ago, people said you couldn't go into the forbidden zone, and nobody remembers why. And it turns out, folklore.
These are just big numbers that are scary, even though there's no like context in terms of like how the economy works or macroeconomics. It's just these big numbers are bigger than I can imagine. And we don't spend time really thinking about macroeconomics and thinking about the scale at which macroeconomics functions on. So suddenly when it comes time that we need to spend a whole bunch of money, people can't wrap their heads around how much money we're talking about, or the scale that we're talking about. And that's the kind of big problem, is that we have these, once a decade or once 20 years, we suddenly, have to talk about this, and everyone has to learn a lot all at once. And it necessarily seems scary, and, can we really do it that big, and so on and so forth. And that's the big problem. So the Federal Reserve is stepping into that void of the rest of the government not responding. So, for example, the program we were just talking about, Main Street Lending Program, that program would not have to exist if the payroll protection program was uncapped. If they provided enough money that was just, forgivable loans, grants to small businesses as needed, even medium-sized businesses, all of the business sector, you wouldn't need to provide small and medium-sized size loans to basically provide a bridge loan until they can start making money again. And that's what the Main Street Lending Program is really supposed to do. But it's, obviously it's a loan. It's not the grant like or forgivable loans the way the payroll protection program is supposed to be. And it has a little bit in it. It defers payment on principal and interest for a year. So it gives you a little bit of a leeway, and that's kind of in and of itself unprecedented for the Fed. But it's still nowhere near enough. And that's kind of the big, takeaway in terms of all that the Federal Reserve is doing, is the Federal Reserve is stepping into doing some fiscal policy, even though it's very uncomfortable with doing fiscal policy, by, say, deferring these the principal and interest on these loans for a year. But it's not willing to go the full way, because Congress hasn't fully authorized it to be a fiscal authority, but it feels compelled to do something because the rest of the federal government is missing in action.
Okay, so just to be clear, by deferring interest for a year, and does that interest accumulate over the course of that year, or does the interest start accruing a year out?
I would have to recheck, but I believe that the interest starts accruing from the time of the loan.
Okay. And so by deferring it for a year, though, it is as if it is spending the money. So it's sort of like just pretending to be, it's doing this sort of mutated version of fiscal policy, but in fact, it's monetary because it's a financial instrument, but it's deferring the financial the financial aspects of it for a year. So there's one free year of money. You have to start paying for that money a year out, but presumably, like, it's like the equivalent of a 20-year loan, but it's actually 21 years to pay it back, essentially.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's to make up for the fact that there's been such an anemic fiscal response by the government. So when does the crap hit the fan? Like, people are walking around their towns now, right? And they can't, it's hard to determine that store has closed, as opposed to it's just, taking a break because we're on pause. Like, it feels like we can't quite see the damage yet, because I've used this in the past as an analogy. Like, the tsunami's hit, the water's come in, and it hasn't receded enough for us to really see the damage yet.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, this has just been so rapid. It's been, the big picture, New York closed its, announced that it was closing its schools and basically closing down the restaurants and such. Like March 12th, I think.
It was 13th. Was a Friday. It was actually the 16th. I mean, the last day for schools was the 13th. Yeah. It was 16th. Yeah. It was a Monday when the closure, all that closure stuff happened.
So that's 2 months. It's just been 2 months. I mean, think about the financial crisis. In the Great Financial Crisis, the anemic response taking. It was clear to people in financial markets that, things were going wrong, at the very latest by March of 2008. And we didn't get, TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, and, the big crisis fronts until the fall, until like October or November.
Right.
We didn't get the stimulus bill until a year after, like March or April of 2009. I talk about the anemic congressional response, but on the scale that they're used to working on, this has been rapid. I mean, we've done multiple spending bills within, this 2 month period. Right. The Federal Reserve, of course, has announced a flurry of programs over those 2 months. So the shock has just been so fast and so sudden that I think people are still, it's still going to be months and months and months before people really fully have a grasp over the economic scale of this. I mean, I think most people, I don't think, are fully grasping what is going on in terms of the employment situation. I mean, we have had a staggering amount of employment losses. I mean, at this point, 30% unemployment, its peak seems optimistic. It seems like, wow, if the response really goes well, we'll get, to just 30% unemployment, which is, obviously Great Depression levels, worse than Great Depression levels, especially with the suddenness of the crisis. I mean, it took 2-3 years before unemployment got that high during the Great Depression. And so this, just the suddenness of it, I think, people are going to fully realize the kind of economic damage and the destruction of people's lives that we're talking about, even beyond the deaths, 3-4 months from now. But by then, the damage will have been so much worse because we're not responding on the scale the crisis demands.
So you've looked at what the Fed is doing, and the biggest problem is that we're having on the fiscal side. What can the Fed, is there anything else that the, I mean, what else can the Fed do at this point without having sort of the fiscal component?
I think the big thing is on the state and local government side. About May 11th, so a week ago, the Fed put out like a pricing on the municipal liquidity facility, basically the interest rates that state and local governments could borrow directly from the Fed, and it's the pricing is very unattractive. You have to pay interest rates well above short-term the current operating level of short-term interest rates in order to borrow from the Federal Reserve using the municipal liquidity facility. If you're below investment grade, remember these are state and local governments. It's not like these are businesses. So, you know, just because a government has, you know, a worse credit rating, and by the way, a credit rating from a private company doesn't mean that the Federal Reserve shouldn't provide support, but it's talking about charging interest rates basically like 6% above the going of overnight interest rates between private actors if you're a below investment grade municipality who wants to borrow. And I think, you know, the Federal Reserve is a federal government entity. These are state and local governments. We're in the middle of a crisis. They should be lending on a preferential basis, not on, you know, on a like a high interest rate basis on the theory that, you know, these entities aren't creditworthy, because, you know, they're state and local governments that are responding to a public health crisis. You know, I personally think that, you know, these facilities should be uncapped, that you should be able to borrow as much as you want from the Federal Reserve for the duration of the crisis at zero interest rates, and, or, you know, at say like 0.5% interest rate. And the Federal Reserve should commit to holding all the debt and not reselling any of the debt that they've purchased from state and local governments for the duration of the crisis and some amount of years after the crisis, say 5 years or so forth. That, like, you know, because you can argue all sorts of things about buying and lending and, you know, the economic effects, but loosening the financial constraints, making sure that that state and local governments don't have to worry about the bills, literally saves lives now. You know, if you told them guaranteed you can spend as much as you want and you're not going to go into bankruptcy, then state and local governments could spend as needed, and that can potentially save thousands of lives.
Why do you think the Fed is? Why do you think Powell and I guess the other the federal board? Why do you think that they're making this decision? Why are they being so I guess chintzy when it comes to state and municipalities?
Historically, the Federal Reserve has been most uncomfortable above everything else with quote unquote picking winners and losers. They don't want to be seen as picking winners and losers. And they obviously, you know, at a certain level are picking winners and losers right now when they're choosing between,
of course,
you know, money that you give non-financial corporations, money you give state and local governments, and so on and so forth. They are, and they're grudgingly acknowledging that, but they're very uncomfortable with it. And so I think they are trying to kind of limit it as much as possible. Okay, we're doing this, but, We're charging, you know, higher interest rates. We're, you know, we're giving the best credit to the most credit worthy companies, and they're trying to find all these outs to go, yes, we're picking winners and losers, but, and to justify, to excuse it, to minimize what they're doing, and to doing something. When I'm talking about doing, you have to lean in. You have to say, yes, I'm picking winners and losers, and the people I don't want to lose are state and local governments right now, because they are on the front lines of fighting this crisis. And that's, you know, that is a very uncomfortable position for them. The other thing is they're worried about losses. They're worried about the politics of, say, losing $50 billion or whatever because of quote unquote defaults from state and local governments. They're worried about that, like, sort of conventional credit worthiness thing, as, you know, as, well, we're stepping a little bit into fiscal policy, but we don't want too much. And that's why they've gone through all these rigmarole, all these accounting gimmicks of, well, we're going to do these facilities, but we want $500 billion from the Treasury that will cover the losses from these facilities. And this kind of, you know, accounting gimmick thing, when it's just, you know, within the federal government, is something that they feel like gives them political cover. And, you know, I'd be telling them to forget about that political cover and just do it and respond to the crisis at the scale it needs, because, you know, they have that responsibility.
Just to be clear, who is the political cover from? I mean, is this a function of the White House not wanting to fund states, states and municipalities because they want to put pressure on these states and municipalities? Is it pressure from, super wealthy people who don't want their if other people are doing okay, it necessarily devalues their wealth, right? I mean, because it's a dynamic.
I think primarily it is definitely Republican Congress people who, you know, rake the Federal Reserve over the coals whenever they do any sort of intervention. But also, you know, in fairness a bit, I think probably also working on worried about some Democratic Congress people, because the flip side of this, of like you respond to the crisis, you know, and you know, go all out, is that that does involve some stepping out of the bounds of their congressional mandate. At the very least, it's stretching it. And you know, there are people on the Democratic side that are just as worried about the Federal Reserve stepping beyond its ambit. And there is a real danger that as Congress inadequately responds to recurring crises and the Federal Reserve expands its ambit more and more, that we essentially put all economic policy into the Fed, and we have very little democratic accountability over what's being done. So I think that there is probably also a little bit of concern. You know, I can easily imagine a Democratic congressperson saying, I'm glad that you were able to respond in this crisis and do this thing, and it ultimately is a good thing. But I am worried about how much power that we're putting into your hands, and about the what it means for democracy that the Federal Reserve as an entity, as an agency, is taking all this increasing power for itself, to be the ones who pick winners and losers. So I think that, you know, there probably is a concern on both sides of the aisle, and definitely also a concern that the bigger that they respond to a crisis, the danger that more of their tools get taken away.
Right.
That what if they respond to a municipal and state government budget crisis so big that tool is taken away explicitly by Congress, and thus they can't, you know, ever help municipal and state governments to any degree. So while, you know, I ultimately think that they should go for it, I do think that there are some, I understand the political considerations that makes them reluctant to go that way. But I think, you know, for example, how unfavorable the pricing on the municipal liquidity facility, I don't think that's really justified. I think, you know, they can make that a much more accessible, much better priced facility with lower interest rates, and, you know, and get away with it, quote unquote, in terms of Congress. And I suspect that, in fact, that they're going to get a lot of criticism for how unfavorably these facilities are priced.
Nathan Tankus, research director from the Modern Money Network, thank you so much for walking us through this. I have a feeling, this is obviously we need this education to understand what's going to be happening and what's not going to be happening going forward. And appreciate your taking the time.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. Before we do, reminder, I am super excited to introduce to you, and you've actually been introduced, but I reintroduced to you one of the coolest sponsors we've ever had, Hunt a Killer. It's a murder mystery subscription box, one of the most unique games out there. Brings the fun of an escape room. I've never done that. But I guess, I don't know, now I'm intrigued by an escape room for that matter, but that's not going to happen for a while.
I watched the escape room movie, and it's actually better than I thought. So this is even more interesting to me now than before.
Well, go to huntakiller.com/majority. Use the promo code majority at checkout. You get 20% off your first box. In the box, you're going to get all sorts of like documents and a couple of photos. It's huntakiller.com/majority with promo code majority. Just a reminder, it's your memberships that help this program chug along. When you become a member, you get the fun half free of commercials. We are, you know, well, we used to have a limit on how many commercials we would do in the fun half, I mean, the free half. But obviously, because of the squeeze, we are making hay while the sun is shining, as it were. But if you become a member, you don't have to listen to any ads. And you support the program and you support other folks who are having financial difficulties at this time. And there's going to be more of that where that came from, sadly. So join the majorityreport.com. Also, don't forget, AM Quickie still chugging along. Check it out. Subscribe at amquickie.com. Justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. I am drinking some as we speak. That is the bike fuel. I'm mixing it up. Los Diosos, bike fuel, Majority Report blends, mixing them all. I'm not mixing them together. Didn't want to do that, but I am, you know, one day this, one day that, just to, it's a spice of life, ladies and gentlemen. Don't forget tomorrow night, TMBS. Matt, do you know who's going to be on the Michael Brooks show tomorrow night?
I think Big Waz, and I'm not sure who the other guest is, but I'll know tomorrow, but I'm excited. I think Waz.
Big Waz, my favorite guest on TMBS.
Waz Neil Hombre, yep. He's my favorite podcaster, I think, so I'm excited for him to be back.
I mean, as opposed to...
Yeah, of course.
Right. So check that out. You can find Michael Brooks' show on YouTube. Also, the Nomiki show. You can find that on patreon.com, the Nomiki show. Nomiki will be with us tomorrow. You can find her on YouTube at Nomiki Const on YouTube. And not 100% sure what she's got going this week, but we will ask her about that tomorrow. And Jamie.
Hello.
Hi.
How's it going over there?
It's going. What's happened on the Intifada this week?
Oh, well, this week on the Intifada, we have a fresh episode of History as a Weapon. Actually, it came out last week, but it's very good, with Sean and Matt Christman, wherein they talk about the terminal decline of U.S. hegemony, our current crisis and everything that's going on with that. And they kind of freak out a little bit before kind of getting hopeful at the end. It's a beautiful journey of two men who love each other very much. So check it out. Patreon.com/TheAntifada. Also, I moderated a panel on coronavirus and the future of work. That's in our feed as well. And this week, we're going to have an episode again with my friend Heather Fortune, the amazing musician and prolific leftist shit poster. And I'm recording that today. I hate to jinx it by plugging it before I record, but knock on wood, it's going to go great.
Hope springs eternal. Matt.
Twitch.tv/literary hangover. Tonight, I'm going to be talking about The Fatal Environment, the myth of the frontier and the age of industrialization while playing Red Dead Redemption for patrons at patreon.com/literary hangover. There's a new installment of the Orweller series, so check that out.
We should say that our guest Nathan Tankus said he enjoyed the show. This is from Brendan, and he just added a Majority Report listener discount to his Substack. So you can go, we'll put the link in the podcast description, and you can go and get 20% off for Majority Report listeners over the next 10 days. So you can check that out. The description is in the podcast and the YouTube thing. The guy's on it. All right, quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number. See you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. you're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
This guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.